Thanks for coming out. It felt like a morning that would be really nice to just sleep in, you know, get up slowly and maybe read the paper. And so if it weren't for my usual habit of coming here, that's maybe what I'd be doing. So this morning I'm talking about one of the parables from the Lotus Sutra. So I think Kate and Michael thought they were going to make it easy on me. Just do one of the parables. That's easy. Oh, yeah, I struggled with this. And as we go through the talk, hopefully I'll be able to show you what it is or reveal to you what it is that I struggled with. And hopefully in some way you'll find it helpful. I'm not sure, but that's my hope. So, unlike many of the other teachings in the Lotus Sutra, the parable of the rich father and poor son is told by four of Buddha's disciples. And these disciples, just so you know their names, are Maha Modgalyayana, Subhuti, Maha Kashyapa, and Maha Katyayana. And they were all long-time disciples. They'd practiced with the Buddha for a long time, and they were kind of advanced in age. They present their story as an offering of gratitude for what they learned when the Buddha taught the Lotus Sutra, that they would become Buddhas. They relate that there was once a boy who left home and became a wanderer. There's no indication in the story that he might have been unhappy. Perhaps he was just an adventurer and certainly a little unwise. So for 50 years, he wandered from place to place, working as a poor hired hand. But one day he found his way to his father's palace. He didn't realize it was his father's home because this palace was in a different city from where he had grown up. His father had grieved over the loss of his only son and had gone everywhere in search of him, but never finding him, at last settled down in this town where he built his palace. He was a man of great wealth, and he built a magnificent mansion. The description in the sutra is quite impressive, so I wrote down a little bit to recite to you. His home was large and expensive, with much gold and silver, seashell and agate, pearls and lapis lazuli, elephants, horses, oxen and sheep, palanquins, buggies and carriages, field workers and servants were there, and a multitude of other people. His revenues and investments spread even to other lands. His traders and customers were everywhere. Tens of millions of billions of people surrounded and honored him. He was always in favor of the king, and all officials and powerful families honored him highly. That sounds like a 20th century success story to me. Pretty magnificent, almost like a fairy tale. And that's a little bit what my impression of the Lotus Sutra is. It's pretty magnificent and colorful, very enticing. And I actually really enjoy that aspect of the Lotus Sutra. Some people, it doesn't quite suit their taste, but it makes me want to kind of enter that world and read more. So the son, arriving at the palace, saw that maybe he could get some work there. Maybe, you know, they need some extra help. And when he looked in, he saw a person so magnificent that he seemed to be a king. He was attended by crowds of servants in the midst of gorgeous surroundings. And he was suddenly overcome with fear, thinking that this house would not employ a man like him. Alarmed at the thought of being seized or enslaved or put in prison, he ran away. Meanwhile, his father caught a glimpse of his son, whose face he had never forgotten. In his great excitement, he immediately sent servants to bring him in. But the son, who had no idea of what was in his father's mind, feared that these servants running after him were coming to kill him or arrest him, and he fainted as he tried to break away from the servants. Seeing all this, the father told the servants not to force the poor man to come. A few days later, he sent two servants in shabby clothes to the wretched hut where his son was staying. He instructed them to entice him with the offer of twice the usual wage for the lowly work of cleaning out the stables. The son was very happy with this, thinking that this lowly type of work was what he was suited for. The rich man allowed the son to become comfortable in this work, but found it really difficult to understand why his son thought so poorly of himself. Eventually, the father dressed in poor clothes and was able to join him at the stables, talk with him, and encourage him. After a time, he told him he wished to treat him just as he did all his employees, as his son. The poor son, for his part, rejoiced in such treatment, but he could never shake the feeling that he was an underling. He was an employee, that's it. The father, bit by bit, gave him more important work to do until at last he was made the manager of all the father's property. The poor son worked faithfully and well, but still he could not throw off the consciousness of his lowliness. In time, the poor son's feeling of inferiority lessened. He had become self-confident, and the father, in anticipation of his death, called together the king and the principal citizens to announce that the man he had taken in was actually his son, and that all his property belonged to this son. It was only now that the poor son realized that the very rich man employing him was actually his father. And he was overjoyed as he learned that his father's vast properties were his own. So that's the story. Kind of a nice fairy tale, like winning the lottery, as somebody did last night, I think. It seems pretty clear that the monks are comparing themselves, and by extension all living beings, to the poor son, who thought they had achieved all that they would be able to achieve, namely, becoming arhats. The rich man of the story is, of course, the Buddha, who exemplifies many of the skillful means that can bring people along and encourage them in their practice. And incidentally, it even shows us that failure can be a part of this teaching and path, like when the father impulsively gets his servants to run after the son and ends up frightening him half to death. One of the most important of the skillful means shown by the father, I felt, was patience. After all, if the son was over 50 when he arrived at the palace, the father must have been at least somewhere around 70, give or take a few years. He took his son through various stages of employment to build his self-confidence step by step. Then he had to find some ways to help his son achieve confidence. This probably took a few years, but the father never seemed to lose his energy or motivation to continue his gentle encouragement. This seems to me to be another of the skillful means we learn of in the paramitas. I sort of likened it to the paramita of virya, or spiritual energy. It's like having the creativity and courage in our practice to keep on finding out what our truest selves are and really ask ourselves what are our deepest questions. And the father, like the Buddha, shows great compassion for his son, accepting that he has had a hard life, has lost confidence, and thinks poorly of himself. He doesn't say, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you fool, and take over the estate. He meets the son at his level, donning shabby clothes, working with him in the stables, and continuing to love him, even though he had to go through this long process. So how does the son's story relate to the story of the four disciples? They, like the poor son, realized that they had lived a life, or that they lived a life of suffering and sought a way out. I think this is how many of us come to practice, by realizing that maybe something in our life doesn't feel quite right, or maybe we're having so much difficulty, we'll try anything to lessen the pain. So the Buddha's disciples followed this path of practice, which led them to become arhats after many long years. I always thought that being an arhat was a pretty good achievement, I guess you could say, because it meant that your practice had allowed you to become a very cool cucumber, as the Complete Idiot's Guide to the Life of Buddha describes. An arhat is someone who has destroyed belief in an eternal self, belief that rituals lead to enlightenment, destroyed doubt, craving, aversion, subtle attachment to the experience in the realm of pure form, subtle attachment to experience in the realm of no form, and destroyed pride, restlessness, and delusion. So that's where they were. Now, sort of looking at our own story as practitioners, or my own story, maybe we also began a meditation practice to feel a bit of relief. We had some, you know, limited ambitions, but eventually we felt that, oh, you know, this is really working. I don't have to take all of the output of my mind so seriously. It's just the mind doing its work of thinking and thinking and thinking. We begin to feel some ease and a bit more peace in our lives. Interested in the effects of this practice, maybe we begin to read about Buddhist philosophy and listen to some Dharma talks. We learn what the Buddha said about suffering and how attachment leads to suffering. At some point, we may decide to adopt the ethical precepts of Buddhism, realizing that they are a pretty good alternative to our usual habit patterns of reacting, maybe without fully realizing why we are reacting that way. Following the precepts, maybe we begin to feel a bit more free of our old ways of thinking, and the heart and mind become more peaceful. So the Buddha, in teaching the Lotus Sutra, says that monks' practices are good and have probably made the monks' lives and other people's lives better. Maybe we can see this in our own practice, and it encourages us to go on. The Buddha goes on, though, to reveal that the monks already have it within them to understand the great questions of life. As in the parable, they were not aware of their lofty origins as children of wealthy parents, not aware of their Buddha nature. So this realization gets clouded over by the suffering we experience in our ordinary human life. So what are these great questions? For me, they seem to be questions that are kind of always in the background of daily life, like, what is this life? What is death? So these questions often arise for me at moments of great difficulty, like illness and the passing of a loved one, or at moments of great beauty, like seeing the first snow fall in the fields of the red-twigged blueberry bushes. Questions inspire wonder, but for some people, occur only once or twice in their lifetime. So the monks sharing the parable had certainly attained great serenity, but given their great joy at hearing about their inherent Buddha nature, it seems likely that achieving the state of being an arhat had not answered all their questions. And I can agree that practicing meditation, listening to Dharma talks, supporting the Sangha, and following the precepts can have a profoundly positive effect on life. They certainly have on mine. And I'm not an accomplished arhat, but I'm deeply grateful for this practice and want to continue to share it. Sorry, I'm jumping around here in my own text. But I have to make a confession now and reveal to you that I really struggled with how I originally interpreted this story. The way the parable was told seemed very linear to me, and it was not clear that the arhats felt or realized that they were always Buddhas, only that they would become Buddhas. The four monks say, after hearing Buddha teach the Lotus Sutra, the following: having observed the Buddha's pure precepts throughout the long night, today for the first time we have obtained the fruit and reward. In the Dharma of the Dharma King, having long observed noble practices, we have now attained the flawless, unexcelled, great fruit. Having practiced in the Soto Zen tradition, I had come to understand that our practice is that of actualizing or making real our inherent Buddhahood. And this has always rung more true to me than the sense of practice as something to be achieved. It's been more like a veil lifting. And I've always felt a bit leery of ideas of great enlightenment, Satori, Kensho, kind of like hallelujah or conversion experiences. As Dogen says and describes in the Shobogenzo, sitting itself is the practice of the Buddha. Sitting itself is non-doing. It is nothing but the true form of the self. Apart from sitting, there is nothing to seek as the Buddha Dharma. Another Dogen scholar says that for Dogen Zenji, his religious experience is not attaining some sudden and special psychological Satori experience. Dogen never talked about such an experience in Shobogenzo. In his teachings, realization is a deep awareness of the fact that the existence of the self is not a personal possession of the self. So it's not a linear experience. I know that Dogen was quite influenced by the Lotus Sutra, and I believe he was able to perceive a message of inherent Buddhahood. He gets right to the heart of this understanding in his important works, Time Being and Actualizing the Fundamental Point. But he also directs us to skillful means and practice in the Fukan Zazengi, which we sometimes chant here. This chant provides detailed instructions on how to sit Zazen. In the first two works, Time Being and Actualizing the Fundamental Point, Dogen makes it clear that we are Buddha, but we cannot grasp this by our usual ways of thinking and feeling. In fact, we cannot grasp it at all. It's kind of like trying to hold water in our hands. So what was I missing from this parable, or in this parable from the Lotus Sutra? I think what I was missing was the fact that these arhats, by posing this parable as their spiritual story, saw themselves as the children who had been wealthy all along. They did not just become wealthy or enlightened when the father or the Buddha made his announcement about his inheritance, just as the Buddha, when he taught the Lotus Sutra, said that they would become Buddhas. I was also forgetting the overall approach of the Lotus Sutra, which moves between stories from the historical life of the Buddha to the fantastic descriptions of the ultimate dimension. The descriptions of the ultimate dimension, as we've learned in earlier Dharma talks, are fantastical because they are meant to shake us out of our habitual ways of thought. and have us realize that things aren't always what they appear to be. As humans, we sit at one point on the horizon of reality and see the world in one way, just as an ant sitting at the top of an anthill sees the world in a completely different way, believing that that's the entire universe. In the Genjo Koan, Dogen describes it like this. When we sail a boat into the ocean beyond sight of land, and our eyes scan the horizon in the four directions, it simply looks like a circle. No other shape appears. This great ocean, however, is neither round nor square. It has inexhaustible characteristics. To a fish, it looks like a palace. To a heavenly being, a jeweled necklace. To us, as far as our eyes can see, it looks like a circle. I think I'm beginning to understand that both situations are true, that we, like the poor son, live our human lives in a temporal world where we have some fixed idea of ourselves, where we experience a lack of confidence, feel fear, and suffer pain. And at the same time, we live in the ultimate dimension of complete connectivity and non-separation. We're already wealthy. We're already enlightenment. So I think that this, for me, was an opportunity to let go of the many times in my practice when I try to push myself and ask myself, am I making enough effort? And am I doing this properly? Am I meditating correctly? And just realize that, yeah, well, I have to make effort, but I'm already Buddha. And just by sitting here, I'm realizing that Buddhahood. So let's continue to practice together our perfect practice in our seemingly imperfect lives. And let's not forget to take care of ourselves and be compassionate towards ourselves with all of our human pain and suffering, and to take care of each other. Thank you. May our intention equally extend to every being and place. The Tao of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them.